Side 11, The Hidden City, The Tomilly, Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 372.
I don't have to breathe, but you do, and I don't want to have to spend an hour fishing you out of that pool one by one after we get there. Now, does anybody else have any problems you haven't told me about? This is the time to talk about them, before we're all underwater.
She looked pointedly at Bevier.
Is there something you'd like to tell me, Sir Knight? You seem to be having a crisis of some sort.
It's nothing, Divine One, he mumbled. I'll be fine. I swim like a fish. He deliberately avoided looking at her.
What's bothering you, then?
I'd really rather not say. She sighed.
Men.
Then she climbed into the shaft leading down toward the unseen water rushing toward the inner wall.
Bring Calton, she ordered, and let's get at this.
I'd really like to do something about that, Sophronia murmured to Vanyan as they peered over the top of the gravel mound at the encampment of the slavers.
So would I, love, Vanyan replied, but I think we'd better wait until later. If everything goes the way it's supposed to, we'll be waiting for them when they reach Sirga.
He raised himself a bit higher.
I think that's the salt flat just beyond that trail they're following.
We'll be able to tell for certain when the moon rises, she replied.
Have you heard anything at all from Afriel?
Nothing I can make any sense of. The echoes are very confusing when she's in two places at the same time. I gather that things are coming to a head in Mytherian, and she and Sparhawk are swimming.
Swimming? This is a desert, Sophronia.
Yes, I noticed that. They've found something to swim in, though.
She paused.
Does Calton know how to swim? She asked.
He splashes a great deal, but he manages to drag himself through the water. I wouldn't call him graceful by any means. Why do you ask?
She's having some sort of problem with him, and it has to do with the swimming. Let's go back and join the others, dear one. Just the sight of those slavers is setting my blood to boiling.
They slid back down the gravel-strewn mound and walked along a shallow gully toward their armored soldiers. The Serenic Knight, Sir Launette, stood somewhat diffidently beside a burly, intricately curled and massively eyebrowed personage with heavy shoulders and a classical demeanor.
Sophronia,
the clearly non-human being said in a voice that could probably have been heard in Thalesia.
Well met.
Well met indeed, Divine Romalic. She replied with just a trace of a weary sigh.
Please, dear, Vanyan murmured. Ask him to lower his voice.
Nobody else can hear him, she assured him. The gods speak loudly, but only to certain ears.
Thy sister bids me give thee greetings,
Romalic announced in a voice of thunder.
Thou art kind to bear those greetings, Divine One.
Kindness and courtesy aside, Sophronia,
the huge god declaimed, combing his beard with enormous fingers.
Art thou yet prepared to serve us all and to assume thy proper place?
I am unworthy, Divine One, she replied modestly. Surely there are others wiser and better suited.
What's this? Vanyan asked.
It's been going on for a long time, dear one, she explained. I've been avoiding it for centuries. Romalic always has to bring it up, though.
It all fell into place in Vanyan's mind.
Sophronia, he gasped. They want you to be over-priestess, don't they?
It's Afriel, Vanyan, not me. They think they can get around her by offering this to me. I don't really want it, and they don't really want to give it to me, but they're afraid of her, and this is their way to placate her.
Afriel bids thee to make haste, Romalic proclaimed. Ye must all be at the gates of Sirga ere dawn, for this is the night of decision, when Sirgon, and yea, even Clow, must be confronted, and, we may hope, confounded. E'en now doth Anakin move ghost-like through the streets of the hidden city toward his design. Let us hasten.
He lifted his voice and thundered,
On to Sirga!
Is he always like this? Vanyan murmured.
Romalic? Sophronia said. Oh, yes. He's perfectly suited to the Serenic Knights. Come along, dear one. Let's go to Sirga.
There were dim, flickering lights far above, but the pool was sunk in inky blackness when Sparhawk surfaced and explosively blew out the breath he had been holding.
Carlton, he heard Afriel saying, wake up.
There was a startled cry and a great deal of splashing.
Oh, stop that, the goddess told Sparhawk's friend. It's all over, and you came through it just fine. Zenisha, dear, could we have a little light? Of a certainty, divine one,
the Anaray replied, and her face began to glow.
Are we all here?
Afriel asked quietly, looking around. As Zenisha's light gradually increased, Sparhawk saw that the goddess appeared to be no more than waist-deep in the pool, and she was holding Carlton up by the back of his tunic.
Do you want to give me a hand with this, Sparhawk?
Bivier said. Right. Sparhawk swam over to join the Serenic, and together they hauled in the slender rope Bivier had trailed behind him as they had come through the tunnel. At the other end of the rope were their tightly bundled mail shirts and swords.
Wait a minute, Bivier said when the rope suddenly went taut. It's caught on something.
He drew in several deep breaths, plunged under the surface, and went hand over hand back along the rope. Sparhawk waited, unconsciously holding his own breath. Then the rope came free, and he hauled it in quickly. Bevier popped to the surface again, blowing out air.
Are you sure you aren't part fish?
Sparhawk asked him.
I've always had good lungs, Bevier replied. Do you think we should get out our swords?
Let's see what Afriel says first, Sparhawk decided, peering around. I don't see any place to climb up out of the water yet.
Now what? Talon was asking the goddess. We're swimming around at the bottom of a well here.
He looked up at the sheer sides of the shaft rising from the pool. There are some openings up there, but there's no way to get to them.
Did you bring it, Mirtai?
Afriel asked. The giantess nodded.
Excuse me a moment, she said,
and she sank beneath the surface and began to pull off her tunic.
What's she doing?
Talon asked, peering down through the clear water.
She's taking off her clothes, Afriel replied, and she doesn't need any help from you. Keep your eyes where they belong.
You run around naked all the time, he protested. Why should you care if we watch Mirtai get undressed?
It's entirely different, she replied in a lofty tone. Now do as you're told.
Talon thrust himself around in the water, until he had his back to Mirtai.
I'm never going to understand her, he grumbled. Oh, yes, you will, Talon, she told him in a mysterious little voice. But not quite yet. I'll explain it all to you in a few more years.
Then Mirtai rose to the surface, holding the coil of rope that had been slung over her shoulder under her tunic.
I'll need something to stand on, Afriel, she said,
hefting the grappling hook attached to one end of the rope.
I won't be able to throw this while I'm treading water.
All right, gentlemen, Afriel said primly. Eyes front.
Sparhawk's smile was concealed in the dimness. Talon was right. Afriel seemed almost unaware of her own nakedness. But Mirtai's was an entirely different matter. He heard the sound of water trickling off the sleek limbs of the golden giantess as she rose to stand, he surmised, on its very surface. Then he heard the whistling sound of the grappling hook as Mirtai swung it in wider and wider circles. Then the whistling stopped for an interminable, breathless moment. There was the clink of steel on stone high above, followed by a grating sound as the points dug in.
Good cast, Afriel said.
Lucky, Mirtai replied. It usually takes two or three throws.
Sparhawk felt a touch on his shoulder.
Here, Mirtai said, handing him the rope. Hold this while I get dressed. Then we'll climb up and go find your wife.
What on earth are you doing, Bergston?
The Patriarch of Emsat started violently and jerked his head around to stare at the god who had just walked up behind him.
You're supposed to be hurrying, you know, Cetrus chided him. Afriel wants everybody to be in place by morning.
We came across some of Clell's soldiers, Divine One, Sir Heldon rumbled. They're inside that cave.
He pointed at a barely visible opening in the hillside across the shallow gully.
Why didn't you deal with them? I told you how to do it.
We put a lantern in there,
But there's a door inside the cave, Cetrus God,
Etana Maris advised him.
Well, open it, dear lady, Cetrus said. We really must reach Serga by morning. Afriel will be terribly vexed with me if we're late.
We'd gladly open it if we knew how, Divine One, Brigston told him. But late or not, I won't ride away from here and leave those monsters behind me. And if that vexes Afriel, that's just too bad.
The handsome, stupid god irritated Brigston for some reason.
Why do I have to do everything myself? Cetrus sighed. Wait here, I'll deal with this, and then we'll be able to move on. We're terribly behind schedule, you know. We'll have to get cracking if we're going to make it by morning.
He strolled on across the rocky gully and entered the cave.
That young fellow's really trying my patience, Brigston muttered. Trying to explain something to him is like talking to a brick. How can he be so...
Brigston pulled up short just this side of heresy.
He's coming back out, Etana Maris said. I thought he might, Brigston said with some satisfaction. Apparently he didn't have any better luck with that door than we did.
Cetrus was strolling toward them, humming a styric melody, when the entire hill vanished in a great fiery explosion that shook the very earth. The fire billowed out with a dreadful, seething roar, hurling Brigston and the others to the ground and engulfing Afriel's cousin.
Dear God!
Brigston gasped, staring at the boiling fire. Then Cetrus, with not so much as a hair out of place, came sauntering out of the fire.
There now, he said mildly. That wasn't so difficult, was it?
How did you get the door open, Divine One? Heldon asked curiously.
I didn't, old boy, Cetrus smiled. Actually, they opened it for me.
Why would they do that?
I knocked, dear boy, I knocked. Even creatures like that have some manners. Shall we be going, then?
They are much feared by the other Sirgai,
Zenisha reported,
and all do give way to them.
That would be useful if it weren't for the racial differences,
Bevier noted.
Such differences do not pose an insurmountable obstacle, Sir Knight,
Zenisha assured him.
Should it prove needful, thy features and those of thy companions may once more be altered. Divine Afriel can doubtless serve in her sister's stead in the combining of the two spells which do yet disguise ye.
We can talk about that in a moment, Flute said. First, though, I think we should all get some idea of how this part of the city's laid out.
The goddess had resumed her more familiar form, and Bevier, for one, seemed much relieved.
Methinks this mount is not of natural origin, Divine One,
Zenisha told her.
The sides are of uniform steepness, and the avenues which do ascend to the top are more stairways than streets. Cross streets, however, do encircle the hill at regular intervals.
Unimaginative, aren't they? Mirtai observed. Are there many of them wandering around out there?
Nay, Etana, 'tis late, and most have long since sought their beds.
We could chance it, Carlton mused. If Flute and Zanisha can make us look like Sirgai, we could just march right up the hill.
Not in these clothes we can't, Sparhawk disagreed.
Talon slipped out of the shadows to re-enter the passageway leading back to the central shaft of the well. In many ways, the agile young thief could be nearly as invisible as Zanisha.
More soldiers coming, he whispered.
Those patrols could get to be a nuisance, Carlton said.
These aren't like those others,
Talon told him. They aren't patrolling the side streets. They're just climbing the stairs toward the top of the city. They aren't wearing the same kind of armor, either.
Describe them, young Master Talon,
Zenisha said intently. They're wearing cloaks, for one thing, Talon replied, and they've got a sort of emblem on their breastplates. Their helmets are different, too.
Temple guards, then,
Zenisha said.
The ones of which I spake earlier. I did glean from the thought of such few as I encountered that other Sirgai do avoid them insofar as they might, and that all are obliged to bow down when they pass.
Sparhawk and Bevier exchanged a long look.
There are the clothes you wanted, Sparhawk, Bevier said.
How many are there? Sparhawk asked Talon. I counted 10. Sparhawk considered it.
Let's do it, he decided, but try to keep the noise down. And he led them out of the passageway into the street.
Good God, Olaf, Itania exclaimed. Don't do that. My heart almost stopped.
Sorry, Itania, the big Salesian apologized. There's no really graceful way to come out of no time. Let's go talk with Betwana and Engessa.
They rode back to join the queen and her general.
Sir Olaf just arrived with news, Your Majesty, Itania said politely.
Ah, she said. Good news or bad news, Olaf Knight?
A little of each, Your Majesty, he replied. The trolls are a couple of miles east of here.
And what's the good news? He smiled slightly.
That is the good news. The bad news is that there's another large force of Klell's soldiers waiting in ambush just south of here. They'll probably hit you within the hour. They're in our way, and we have to hurry. Sparhawk and the others are going to rescue Elana and her maid tonight, and he wants us all to converge on the city by morning.
We must fight the Klell beasts, then, she said.
That could be troublesome, Itania murmured.
Tinian and I have worked out a solution of sorts, Olaf continued, but we don't want to offend you, Your Majesty, so we thought I should stop by and talk it over first. Klell's troops are preparing to ambush you. I know you'd prefer to deal with that yourself, but in the interests of expediency, would you be willing to forgo the pleasure?
I'd be willing to listen, Olaf Knight, she said.
There are ways we could just slip around that ambush, but Klell can probably do the same kinds of things to time and distance that Afriel and her cousins can, and I don't think we want those brutes coming up behind us.
What's your solution, then, Olaf Knight?
I've got a sizable force at my disposal, Your Majesty, he replied, and they're hungry. Since we're too busy right now for an extended romp through the desert, why don't we just let the trolls have Klell's soldiers for breakfast?
Sir Anosian looked a little shaken as he rode forward to speak with Kring and Takumi.
What's the matter, friend Anosian? Takumi asked the black-armored Pandian. You look as if you just saw a ghost.
Worse, friend Takumi, Anosian replied. I've just been reprimanded by a god. Most men don't survive that experience.
Afriel again?
Kring guessed.
No, friend Kring. This time it was her cousin, Honka. He's very abrupt. The Genidian knights rely on him for assistance with their spells.
He was unhappy with you? Takumi asked. What did you do this time?
Anosian made a sour face.
Sometimes my spells are a little floppy, he admitted. Afriel's generous enough to forgive me. Her cousin isn't. He shuddered. Divine Honka's going to hurry us along just a bit.
Oh?
We have to be at the gates of Sirga by morning.
How far is it?
Kring asked him.
I have no idea, Anosian admitted, and under the circumstances, I didn't think it would be prudent to ask.
Honka wants us to ride west from here.
Takumi frowned.
If we don't know how far it is, how can we be sure we'll get there by morning?
Oh, we'll get there all right, friend Takumi, Anosian assured him. I think we'd better start moving, though. Divine Honka's notoriously short-tempered. If we don't start riding west very soon, he might just decide to pick us up and throw us from here to Sirga.
The temple guardsman assumed a warlike posture, a rather stiff, formalized pose, such as one occasionally sees on a frieze carved by an indifferently talented sculptor. Calton brushed the man's sword aside and slammed his fist against the side of his helmet. The guardsman reeled away, and fell heavily onto the cobblestones. He was struggling to rise again when Calton kicked him solidly in the face.
Quietly, Calton, Sparhawk said in a hoarse whisper.
Sorry, I guess I got carried away.
Calton bent and peeled back the fallen guardsman's eyelid.
He'll sleep till noon, he said.
He straightened and looked around. Is that all of them?
That was the last, Bevier whispered. Let's get them out of the middle of the street. The moon's going to make it up over those mountains soon, and it'll be as bright as day down in this basin in just a little while. It had been a short, ugly little fight. Sparhawk and his friends had rushed out of a dark side street and had fallen on the detachment from the rear. Surprise had accounted for much of their success, and what surprise had not accomplished had been more than made up for by the ineptitude of the ceremonial troops. Sparhawk concluded that the Sirgai looked impressive, but that their training over the centuries had grown so formalized and detached from reality that it had almost become more a form of dance than a preparation for real combat. Since the Sirgai could not cross the Sirik curse line, they had not been involved in any real fights for 10,000 years, and so they were hopelessly unprepared for all the nasty little tricks that crop up from time to time in close hand-to-hand fighting.
I still don't see how we're going to pull this off, Talon puffed as he dragged an inert guardsman back into the shadows. One look will tell the gate guards that we're not Sirgai.
We've already discussed that, Sparhawk told him, while you were out scouting. Zanisha and Afriel are going to mix spells again, the way the Anaray and Sophrenia did back in Mytherian. We'll look enough like Sirgai to get us through the gate, particularly if the rest of the Sirgai are as much afraid of these temple guardsmen as Zanisha says they are.
As long as the subjects come up, Coulson said, after we've bluffed our way past those gate guards, I want my own face back. We stand a fair chance of getting killed tonight, and I'd like to have my own name on my tombstone. Besides, if by some remote chance we succeed, I don't want to startle Aileen by coming at her with a stranger's face. After what she's been through, she's entitled to see the real me.
I don't have any problem with that, Sparhawk agreed.
Chapter 30 Captain Jodrell returned just after dark, his loose robe flapping and his eyes wide as he desperately flogged at his horse.
We're doomed, my general! He shrieked.
Get control of yourself, Jodrell, General Pyrrha snapped. What did you see?
There are millions of them, General.
Jodrell was still on the verge of hysteria.
Jodrell, you've never seen a million of anything. Now what's out there?
They're coming across the Sarna, General, Jodrell replied, trying his best to control his quavering voice. The reports about that fleet are true. I saw the ships.
Where? We're 10 leagues from the coast.
They've sailed up the River Sarna, General Pyrrhus, and they've lashed their ships together side by side to form bridges.
Absurd! The Sarna's 5 miles wide down here. Talk sense, man.
I know what I saw, General. The other scouts will be along shortly to confirm it. Kaftal's in flames. You can see the light of the fire from here.
Jodrell turned and pointed south toward a huge, flickering orange glow in the sky above the low coastal hills standing between the Senescan forces and the sea. General Pyrrhus swore. This was the third time this week that his scouts had reported a crossing of the Lower Sarna or the Varel River, and he had not thus far seen any sign of hostile forces. Under normal circumstances, he'd have simply had his scouts flogged or worse. But these were not normal circumstances. The enemy force that had been harrying the southern coast was made up of the Knights of the Church of Kyrellus, sorcerers to a man, who were quite capable of vanishing and then reappearing miles to his rear. Still muttering curses, he summoned his adjutant.
Salat, he snapped, wake up the troops. Tell them to prepare themselves. If those accursed knights are crossing the Sarna here, we'll have to engage them before they can establish a foothold on this side of the river.
It's just another ruse, my general, his adjutant said, looking at Captain Jodrell with contempt. Every time some idiot sees 3 fishermen in a boat, we get a report of a crossing.
I know, Salat, Pyrrhus replied, but I have to respond. King Jalua will have my head if I let the knights get across those rivers.
The general spread his hands helplessly.
What else can I do?
He swore again.
Sound the charge, Salat. Maybe this time we'll find somebody real when we reach the river.
Aileen was trembling violently when Zelasta returned the 2 captives to the small but now scrupulously clean cell following yet another of those hideous, silent interviews with the Batwing's Clell. But Elana felt drained of all emotion. There was a perverse seductiveness to the strangely gentle probing of that infinite mind, and Elana always felt violated and befouled when it was over.
"That will be the last time, Elana," Zelasta told her apologetically. "If it's any comfort to you, he's still baffled by your husband. He cannot understand how any creature with such power would willingly subordinate himself to..."
He hesitated. "To a mere woman, Zelasta?" she suggested wearily.
"No, Elana, that's not it. Some of the worlds Clell dominates are wholly ruled by females, and males are kept for breeding purposes only. No, Clell simply cannot understand the relationship between you and Sparhawk."
"You might explain the meaning of love to him, Zelasta." She paused. "But you don't understand it yourself, do you?"
His face went cold. "Good night, Your Majesty," he said in an unemotional tone. Then he turned and left the cell, closing and locking the door behind him. Elana had her ear pressed to the door before the clanging echo of its closing had subsided.
"I do not fear them," she heard King Centiocles declare.
"Then you're a bigger fool than I thought," Zelasta told him bluntly. "All of your allies have been systematically neutralized, and your enemies have you surrounded."
"We are Sirgai," Centiocles insisted. "No one can stand against us."
"That may have been true 10,000 years ago, when your enemies dressed in furs and charged your lines with flint-tipped spears. Now you face church knights armed with steel. You face Aton warriors who can kill your soldiers with their fingertips. You face Poloi who ride through your ranks like the wind. You face trolls who not only kill your soldiers, but also eat them. If that weren't bad enough, you face Afriel, who can stop the sun or turn you to stone. Worst of all, you face Annika and Belium, and that means that you face obliteration."
"Mighty Sirgon will protect us."
Centiocles' voice was set in a willful note of stubborn imbecility.
"Why don't you go talk with Otha of Zemok, Centiocles?"
There was a sneer in Zelasta's voice.
"He'll tell you how the elder god Azash squealed when Annika destroyed him."
Zelasta suddenly broke off.
"He comes," he choked, "closer than we'd ever thought possible."
"What are you talking about?"
the Akatis demanded.
"Annika is here," Zelasta exclaimed. "Go to your generals, Centiocles. Tell them to call out their troops and order them to scour the streets of Sirga, for Annika is within your walls. Hurry, man, Annika is here, and our death stalk the streets with him. Come with me, Akatis. Sirgon must be warned, and Eternal Clell, the night of decision is upon us."
"And thou, O Blue, all cares and griefs shall ban, and lift our hearts to heights unknown to mortal man." Elrond ticked off the count on his fingers and swore. No matter how he slurred or compressed the words of that last line, it still had one beat too many. He hurled his quill pen across the room and sank his face into his hands in an artful pose of poetic despair. Elrond did that frequently when composing verse. Then he hopefully raised his face as a thought came to him. He was nearing the final stanzas of his masterpiece after all, and an Alexandrin would add emphasis. What would the critics say? Elrond agonized over the decision. He cursed the day when he had chosen to cast the most important work of his career in heroic couplets. He hated iambics. They were so mercilessly regular and unforgiving, and pentameter was like a chain around his neck, jerking him up short at the end of every line. Ode to Blue hung in the balance, while her creator struggled with the sullen intransigencies of form and meter. Elrond could not be sure how long the screaming had been going on, or exactly when it had started. His mind, caught up in a creative frenzy, had blotted out everything external to that one maddeningly recalcitrant line. The poet rose irritably to his feet and went to the window to look out at the torchlit streets of Nataios.
What were they screaming about? Scarpa's soldiers, ignorant, unwashed serfs for the most part, were running, bawling in terror like so many bleating sheep. What had set them off this time? Elrond leaned slightly out to look up the street. There seemed to be a different kind of light coming from the part of the ruined city that was still buried in tangled brush and creeping vines. Elrond frowned. It was most definitely not torchlight. It seemed to be a pale white glow instead. Steady, unwavering, and coming from dozens of places at the same time. Then Elrond heard Scarpa's voice rising over the screams. The crazy charlatan was shouting orders of some kind in his most imperial voice. The rabble in the streets, however, were ignoring him. The army was streaming along the cobbled streets of ruined Natios toward the main gate, pushing, howling, jamming together and struggling to get through that hopelessly clogged gateway. Beyond the gate, Elrond saw winking torches streaming off into the surrounding jungle. What in God's name was going on here? Then his blood suddenly froze. He gaped in horror at the glowing figures emerging from the side streets of the ruin to stalk implacably along the broad avenue that led to the gate. The Shining Ones, who had depopulated Panandia, Narenja, and Sinequa, had finally descended on Natios. The poet stood frozen for only a moment, and then his mind moved more quickly than he'd have thought possible. Flight was clearly out of the question. The gate was so completely jammed that even those who had already reached it had little chance of forcing their way through. Elrond dashed to his writing table and swatted his candle with the flat of his hand, plunging the room into darkness. If there were no lights in the windows of this upper floor, the horrors that stalked the streets would have no reason to search. Frantically, stumbling in the darkness, he ran from room to room, desperately searching for any other burning candles that might betray his location. Then, certain that he was safe for the moment at least, the one known throughout Estelle as Saber crept back to his room to peer fearfully around the edge of the window frame at the street below. Scarpa stood atop a partially collapsed wall, issuing contradictory commands to regiments that evidently only he could see. His threadbare velvet cloak was draped over his shoulders, and his makeshift crown was slightly askew. Not far from where he stood, Sizzada was saying something in his hollow voice, an incantation of some kind, Elrond guessed, and his fingers were weaving intricate designs in the air. Louder and louder he spoke in guttural spirit, summoning God only knew what horrors to face the silent, glowing figures advancing on him. His voice rose to a screech, and he pawed at the air, frantically exaggerating the gestures. And then one of the incandescent intruders reached him. Sizzada screamed and flinched back violently. But it was too late. The glowing hand had already touched him. He reeled back as if that almost gentle touch had been some massive blow. Staggering, he turned as if to flee. And Elrond saw his face. The poet retched, clamping his hands over his mouth to hold in any sound that might give away his presence. Sizzada of Issos was dissolving. His already unrecognizable face was sliding down the front of his head as if it were melted wax, and a rapidly spreading stain was discoloring the front of his white styric robe. He staggered a few steps toward the still raving Scarpa, his arms reaching hungrily out toward the madman, even as the flesh slid away from those skeletal, outstretched hands. Then the styric slowly collapsed to the stones, bubbling and seething, his decaying body oozing out through the fabric of his robe.
"Archers, to the front!" Scarpa commanded in his rich, theatrical voice. "Sweep them with arrows!"
Elrond fell to the floor and scrambled away from the window.
"Cavalry, to the flanks!" he heard Scarpa command. "Sabers, at the ready!"
Elrond crawled toward his writing table, groping in the dark.
"Imperial guardsmen," Scarpa bellowed. "Quick time, march!"
Elrond found the leg of the table, reached up, and frantically began grabbing at the sheets of paper lying on the tabletop.
"First regiment, charge!" Scarpa commanded in a great voice.
Elrond knocked over the table, whimpering in his desperate haste.
"Second regiment!"
Scarpa's voice broke off suddenly, and Elrond heard him scream. The poet spread his arms, trying to gather the priceless pages of Ode to Blue out of the darkness. Scarpa's voice was shrill now.
"Mother!"
he shrieked.
"Please, please, please!"
The resonant voice had become a kind of liquid screech. Please, please, please! It sounded almost like a man trying to cry out from underwater. Please, please, please! And then the voice wheezed off into a dreadful, gurgling silence. Clutching the pages he had found, Saber abandoned his search for any others, scurried across the room on his hands and knees, and hid under the bed. Blockus' expression was reproachful as he shambled back across the night-shrouded gravel.
"Wickedness, Ulat," he accused. "We are packmates, and you said a thing to me that was not so."
"I would not do that, Blockus," Ulat protested.
"You put the thought into my mind belly that the big things with iron on their faces were good to eat. They are not good to eat."
"Were they bad to eat, Blockus?" Tinian asked. Sympathetically.
"Very bad to eat, Tinin. I have not tasted anything so bad to eat before."
"I did not know this, Blockus,"
Ulof tried to apologize.
"It was my thought that they were big enough that one or two might fill your belly."
"I only ate one," Blockus replied. "It was so bad to eat that I did not want to eat another. Not even ogres would eat those, and ogres will eat anything. It makes me not glad that you said the thing that was not so to me, Ulat."
"It makes me not glad as well," Ulat confessed. "I said a thing which I did not know. It was wicked of me to do this."
Queen Betwana drew Tinian aside.
"How long will it take us to reach the hidden city, Tinian Knight?" she asked.
"Is your majesty talking about how long it's really going to take, or how long it's going to seem?"
"Both."
"It's going to seem like weeks, Betwana Queen, but in actual time it'll be instantaneous. Ulath and I left Mytherion just a few weeks ago in real time, but it seems that we've been on the road for nearly a year. It's very strange, but you get used to it after a while."
"We must start soon if we are to reach Sirga by morning."
"Ulath and I'll have to talk with Gnome about that. He's the one who stops time, but he's also the god of eat. He may not be happy with us. The idea of letting the trolls kill Clell's soldiers was a good one, but Gnome expects them to eat what they kill, and they don't like the taste." She shuddered.
"How can you stand to be around the troll beasts, Tinian Knight? They're horrible creatures."
"They aren't really so bad, Your Majesty," Tinian defended them. "They're very moral, you know. They're fiercely loyal to their own packs. They don't even know how to lie. And they won't kill anything unless they intend to eat it, or unless it attacks them. As soon as Ulath finishes apologizing to Blockus, we'll summon Gnome and talk with him about stopping time so that we can get to Sirga." Tinian made a face. "That's what's going to take a while. You have to be patient when you're trying to explain something to the troll gods."
"Is that what Ulath Knight is doing?" she asked curiously. "Apologizing?"
Tinian nodded.
"It's not as easy as it sounds, Your Majesty. There's nothing in trollish that even comes close to I'm sorry, probably because trolls never do anything that they're ashamed of."
"Will you be still?" Lyatris hissed at the protesting Gehenus. "They're in the next room right now."
The three empresses were hiding in a dark antechamber adjoining the Tegan's private quarters. Lyatris stood at the door with her dagger in her hand. They waited in tense apprehension.
"They're gone now," Lyatris said. "We'd better wait for a little while, though." "Will you please tell me what's going on?" Gehenus asked. "Chakal sent some people to kill you," Elisun told her. "Lyatris and I found out about it and came to rescue you."
"Why would Chakal do that?"
"Because you know too much about what she's planning."
"That silly plan to implicate Sierona in a spurious assassination plot?"
"The plot wasn't spurious, and Sierona wasn't even remotely connected with it. Chakal and Torelia are planning to kill our husband."
"Treason!"
Gehenus gasped.
"Probably not. Chakal and Torelia are members of royal houses currently at war with the Tamil Empire, and they're getting orders from home. The assassination of Sarabian could technically be called an act of war."
Ella soon stopped as a wave of nausea swept over her.
"Oh, dear," she said in a sick little voice. "What's wrong?"
Lyatris demanded.
"It's nothing. It'll pass. Are you sick?" "Sort of. It's nothing to worry about. I should have eaten something when you woke me up. That's all."
"You're white as a sheet. What's wrong with you?"
"I'm pregnant, if you really have to know."
"It was bound to happen eventually, Ellisoon," Gehenna said smugly. "I'm surprised it didn't happen earlier, the way you carry on. Have you any idea at all of who the father is?"
"Sarabian,"
Ellisoon replied with a shrug of her shoulders.
"Do you think it's safe to leave now, Lyatris? I think we'd better get to our husband as quickly as we can. Chaco wouldn't have sent people to kill Gehenis unless this was the night when she was planning her attempt on Sarabian."
"She'll have people watching all the doors," Lyatris said.
"Not all the doors, dear."
Ellisoon smiled.
"I know of at least three that she's not aware of. You see, Gehenis, there are some advantages to having an active social life. Check the hallway, Lyatris. Let's get Gehenis out of here before Chaco's assassins come back."
The seer guy at the bronze gate stood back fearfully as Sparhawk led the others up the last few steps.
"Yalla, Sirgan,"
the officer in charge said, smashing his fist against his breastplate in a kind of formal salute.
"Respond, Annika,"
Zenisha's voice murmured in Sparhawk's ear.
"'Tis customary."
"Yalla, Sirgan," Sparhawk said, also banging on his chest and being careful not to allow the cloak he'd removed from the unconscious temple guardsman to open and reveal the fact that he was wearing his male shirt rather than an ornate breastplate. The officer seemed not to notice. Sparhawk and the others marched through the gate and moved along a broad street toward a kind of central square. "Is he still watching?" Sparhawk muttered.
"Nay, Annika,"
Zenisha replied.
"He and his men have returned to the guard room beside the gate."
It had appeared from below that the only buildings within the walls at the summit of Sirga were the fortress palace and the temple. But that was not entirely true. There were other structures as well. Low, utilitarian-looking buildings. Storehouses for the most part, Sparhawk guessed. "Talon," he said over his shoulder. "Ease over to the side of the street. Find a door you can get open in a hurry. Let's get out of sight while Zanisha scouts around." "Right," Talon replied. He ducked into the shadows, and a moment later they heard his whisper and quickly moved to the door he was holding open for them. "Now what?" Carlton asked.
"Zanisha and I go looking for Elana and Aileen,"
Afriel's voice replied out of the darkness.
"Where were you?"
Talon asked curiously.
"When we were coming up the hill, I mean." "Here and there," she replied. "My family's moving all the others into position, and I wanted to be sure everything's going according to schedule."
"Is it?"
"It is now. There were a couple of problems, but I took care of them. Let's get at this, Zanisha. We still have a lot to do before morning."
"Ah, there they are," Citra said. "I wasn't really all that far off now, was I?"
"Are you sure this time?" Bergston demanded.
"You're cross with me, aren't you, Bergston?" Bergston sighed and decided to let it pass.
"No, Divine One," he replied. "We all make mistakes, I guess."
"That's frightfully decent of you, old boy." Citrus thanked him. "We were moving in generally the right direction. I was just off a few degrees, that's all."
"Are you certain those are the right peaks this time, Divine One?" Heldon rumbled.
"Oh, absolutely," Citrus said happily. "They're exactly as Afriel described them. You notice how they glow in the moonlight?" Heldon squinted across the desert at the two glowing spires rearing up out of the dark jumble of broken rock.
"They look about right," he said dubiously.
"I have to go find the gate," Citra told him. "It's supposed to be exactly on a line from the gap between the two peaks."
"Are you sure, Divine One?" Bergston asked. "It's that way on the south side, but do we know for certain that it's the same here on the north?"
"You've never met Sirgan, have you, old boy? He's the most rigid creature you've ever seen. If there's a gate on the south, there'll be one on the north as well. Believe me. Don't go away. I'll be right back." he turned and strolled off across the desert toward the two peaks glowing in the moonlight. Etana Maris was standing to one side of Bergston and Heldon with a slightly troubled look on her face.
"What's the matter, Etana?" Heldon asked her.
"I think there is something I do not understand, Heldon Knight," she replied, struggling to put her thought into a lenix. "The Cetrus person is a god?"
"A spirit god, yes."
"If he is a god, how did he get lost?"
"We're not certain, Etana Maris."
"That is what I do not understand. If Cetrus god were a human, I would say that he is stupid. But he is a god, so he cannot be stupid, can he?"
"I think you'd better take that up with his grace here," Heldon replied. "I'm only a soldier. He's the expert on theology."
"Thanks, Heldon," Bergston said in a flat tone of voice.
"If he is stupid, Bergston priest, how can we be certain that he's brought us to the right place?"
"We have to trust Aphriel, Etana. Cetrus may be a little uncertain about things, but Aphriel isn't, and she talked with him for quite some time, as I recall." "Speaking slowly," Heldon added, "and using short, simple words."
"Is it possible, Bergston priest?" Maris asked insistently. "Can a god be stupid?"
Bergston looked at her helplessly.
"Ours isn't," he evaded, "and I'm sure yours isn't either." "You didn't answer my question, Bergston."
"You're right, Etana," he replied.
"I didn't, and I'm not going to. If you're really curious, I'll take you to Kyrellos when this is all over, and you can ask Dolmoth."
"Bravely spoken, Lord Bergston," Heldon murmured.
"Shut up, Heldon."
"Yes, Your Grace."
Sparhawk, Bevier, and Calton stood at a small barred window in the musty-smelling warehouse, looking out at the fortress-like palace rearing above the rest of the city.
"That's really archaic," Bevier said critically.
"It looks strong enough to me," Calton said.
"They've built the main structure of the palace right up against the outer wall, Calton. It saves building two walls, but it compromises the structural integrity of the fortress. Give me a couple of months and some good catapults, and I could pound the whole thing to pieces."
"I don't think catapults had been invented when they built it, Bevier," Sparhawk said. "It was probably the strongest fort in the world 10,000 years ago."
He looked out at the gloomy, rearing pile. As Bevier had noted, the main structure was backed up against the wall that separated this part of Sirga from the rest of the city. Shorter towers stair-stepped up to the large central tower that shouldered high above the rest of the palace, and grew, or so it seemed, out of the wall itself. It appeared that the palace had not been built to look out over the city, but rather to face the white limestone temple. The Sirgai clearly looked at their god, and turned their backs on the rest of the world. The door that Talon had unlocked to provide them entry into the storehouse creaked as it opened, and then closed again. Then the soft glow of Zanisha's face once again dimly illuminated the area around her.
"We found them," the child goddess said, as the Anaray set her down on the flagstone floor.
Sparhawk's heart leaped.
"Are they all right?"
"They haven't been treated very well. They're tired and hungry and very much afraid. Zelasta took them to see Clell, and that's enough to frighten anybody."
"Where are they?"
Mirtai demanded intently.
"At the very top of that highest tower at the back of the palace."
"Did you talk with them?"
Calton asked intently. Aphriel shook her head.
"I didn't think it was a good idea. What they don't know about, they can't talk about."
"Anaray," Bevier said thoughtfully, "would the soldiers in the palace let temple guardsmen move around freely in there?"
"Nay, Sir Knight, the Sirgai are much driven by custom, and temple guardsmen have little cause to enter the palace."
"I guess we can discard these, then," Calton said, pulling off the ornate bronze helmet and dark cloak he had purloined in the lower city.
He touched his cheek.
"We still look like Sirgai. We could steal some different uniforms and then just march in, couldn't we?"
Zanisha shook her head.
"The soldiers within the palace are all kinsmen, members of the royal clan, and are all known to one another. Subterfuge would be far too perilous."
"We've got to come up with a way to get into that tower," Calton said desperately.
"I already have,"
Mirtai told him calmly.
It's dangerous, but I think it's the only way.
Go ahead, Sparhawk told her.
We might be able to sneak up through the palace, but if we're discovered, we'd have to fight, and that'd put Elana and Aileen in immediate danger.
Sparhawk nodded bleakly. It's just too dangerous to risk, he agreed.
All right, then. If we can't go through the palace, we'll have to go up the outside.
You mean climb the tower? Calton asked incredulously.
It's not as difficult as it sounds, Calton. Those walls aren't built of marble, so they aren't smooth. They're rough stone blocks, and there are plenty of handholds and places to put your feet. I could climb that back wall like a ladder if I had to.
I'm not really very graceful, Mirtai, he said dubiously. I'll do anything at all to rescue Aileen, but I won't be much good to her if I make a misstep and fall 500 feet into the lower city.
We have ropes, Calton. I'll keep you from falling. Talon can scamper up a wall like a squirrel, and I can climb almost as well. If we had Stragan and Kaalador along, they'd be halfway up the side of that tower by now.
Mirtai, Bevier said in a pained voice, we are wearing mail shirts. Climbing a sheer wall with 70 pounds of steel hanging from your shoulders might be a little challenging.
Then take it off, Bevier. I might need it when I get up on top.
No problem, Talon assured him. We'll bundle them all together and pull them up behind us. I do sort of like it, Sparhawk. It's quiet, it's fairly fast, and there probably won't be any guards going hand over hand around the outside of the tower looking for intruders. Mirtai's had training from Stragan and Kaalador, and I was born for burglary. She and I can do the real climbing. We'll drop ropes down to the rest of you at various stages along the way, and you can haul up the mail and swords behind you. We can get to the top of that tower in no time at all. We can do it, Sparhawk. It'll be easy. I can't really think of any alternatives, Sparhawk conceded dubiously.
Let's do it then, Mirtai said abruptly. Let's get Elana and Aileen out of there, and once they're safe, we can start to take this place apart.
After I get my real face back, Calton added adamantly. Aileen's entitled to that much consideration.
Let's do that right now, Zanisha, Afriel said. Calton will nag us about it all night if we don't.
Nag? Calton objected.
What color was your hair again, Calton? Purple, wasn't it? She asked him with an impish little smile.
Chapter 31 There were deep shadows along the western side of the women's palace when Elisun, Lyatris, and Gehenis emerged through the little-used door and moved quickly through the darkness to take cover in a nearby grove of ornamental evergreens.
This is going to be the dangerous part, Lyatris cautioned in a low voice. Chocol knows by now that her assassins weren't able to find Gehenis, and she's certain to have her people out to try to prevent us from reaching Aelana's castle.
Elisun looked out at the moon-drenched lawn.
That's impossible, she said. It's just too bright. There's a path that goes on through this grove. It comes out near the Ministry of the Interior.
That's the wrong direction, Elisun, Gehenis protested. The Aleem Castle's the other way.
Yes, I know, but there's no cover. There's nothing between here and the castle but open lawn. We'd better stick to the shadows. If we go around on the other side of Interior, we'll be able to go through the grounds of the Foreign Ministry. It's only about 50 yards from there to the drawbridge of the castle.
What if the drawbridge has been raised?
We'll worry about that when we get there, Gehenis. Let's get into the gardens around the Foreign Ministry first.
Let's go then, ladies, Lyatris said abruptly. We're not accomplishing anything by standing around talking. Let's go find out what we're up against.
Back here,
Talon whispered to them, coming out of a narrow alleyway.
The palace wall runs back to the place where it joins the outer fortifications at the end of this alley. The right angle where the two walls meet is perfect for climbing.
Will you need this?
Mirtai asked, holding her grappling hook out to him.
No, I can make it to the top without it. And we'd better not risk having some sentry up there hear the hook banging on the stones. He
he led them back along the alley to the cul-de-sac where the palace wall butted up against the imposing fortifications separating the compound from the rest of the city.
"How high would you say it is?"
Calton asked, squinting upward. It was strange to see Calton's face again after all the weeks it had been disguised. Sparhawk tentatively touched his own face and immediately recognized the familiar contours of his broken nose.
30 feet or so,
Bevier replied softly to Calton's question. Mirtai was examining the angle formed by the joining of the two walls.
This won't be very difficult, she whispered.
The whole structure's poorly designed, Bevier agreed critically.
I'll go up first, Talon said.
Don't do anything foolish up there,
Mirtai cautioned.
Trust me.
He set his foot up on one of the protruding stones of the outer wall and reached for a handhold on the palace wall. He went up quickly.
We'll check for sentries when we get up there,
Mirtai quietly told the others.
Then we'll drop a rope down to you.
She reached up and began to follow the young thief up the angle between the two walls. Bevier leaned back and looked upward. The moon's up now, he said.
Thinkest thou that it might reveal us?
Zenisha asked him. No, Enere, we'll be climbing the north side of the tower, so we'll be in shadow the whole way to the top. They waited tensely, craning their necks to watch the climbers creeping upward.
Somebody's coming,
Calton hissed.
Up there, along the battlements.
The climbers stopped, pulling back into the shadows of the sharp angle between the two walls.
He's got a torch,
Calton whispered.
If he holds it out over those battlements...
He left it hanging. Sparhawk held his breath.
It's all right now, Bevier said. He's going back.
We might want to deal with him when we get up there,
Calton noted.
Not if we can avoid it, Sparhawk disagreed. We don't want somebody else to come looking for him.
Talon had reached the battlements. He clung to the rough stones for a moment, listening. Then he slipped over the top and out of sight. After several interminable moments, Mirtai followed him. Sparhawk and the others waited in the darkness. Then Mirtai's rope came slithering down the wall.
Let's go, Sparhawk said tensely, one at a time.
The building blocks were of rough, square-fractured basalt, and they protruded unevenly from the walls, making climbing much simpler than it appeared. Sparhawk didn't even bother to use the rope. He reached the top and clambered over the battlements.
Do the sentries have any kind of set routine up here? He asked Mirtai.
It seems that each one has his own section of wall, she replied. The one at this end doesn't walk very fast. I'm guessing, but I'd say that it'll be a quarter of an hour before he comes back.
Is there any place where we can take cover before then?
There's a door in that first tower, Talon said, pointing at the squat structure rising at the end of the parapet. It opens onto a stairwell.
Have you taken a look at the back wall yet?
Talon nodded. There's no parapet along that side, but there's a ledge a couple of feet wide where the outer wall joins the back of the palace. We'll be able to make our way along that until we get on that central tower. Then we get to start climbing.
Does the sentry look back there when he reaches this end of the parapet?
He didn't last time, Mirtai said.
Let's look at that stairwell then, Sparhawk decided. As soon as the others are up, we'll hide in there until the sentry reaches this end and starts back. That should give us a half hour to crawl along that ledge to the central tower. Even if he looks around the corner next time, we should be out of the range of his torch by then.
He's right on top of these things, isn't he?
Talon said gaily to Mirtai.
What is this boy's problem?
Sparhawk demanded of the golden giantess.
There's a certain kind of excitement involved in this, Dorlan, Mirtai replied. It sets the blood to pounding.
Dorlan?
Professional joke, Sparhawk. You probably wouldn't understand.
Vanyan's scouts had returned about sunset to report contact with Kryn to the south and Queen Betwana's Aton to the north. The ring of steel around the Forbidden Mountains was drawing inexorably tighter. The moon was rising over the desert when Betwana and Engessa came running in from Vanyan's right flank, and Kryn and Takumi rode in from the left.
Tinian Knight will be along soon, Vanyan Preceptor,
Engessa reported.
He and Olaf Knight have spoken with Bergsten Priest on their right. Olaf Knight has remained with the trolls to try to prevent incidents.
Incidents?
Sophronia asked. The trolls are hungry. Olaf Knight gave them a regiment of the Klell beasts to eat, but the flavor did not please the trolls. Olaf Knight tried to apologize, but I am not sure if the trolls understood.
Have you seen Barret and Khalad yet, friend Vanyan? Kring asked.
No, but Afriel said that they're just ahead of us. Her cousin guided them to the spot where that hidden gate's supposed to be. If they know where the gate is, we could go on in,
Betwana suggested.
We'd better wait, dear,
Sifrinia replied.
Afriel will let me know as soon as Sparhawk rescues Elana and Aileen.
Tinian came riding across the vast open graveyard.
Bergston's in place, he reported, swinging down out of his saddle.
He looked at Itania.
I have a message for you, Your Excellency.
Oh? From whom?
Etana Maris is with Bergston.
She wants to talk with you.
Itania's eyes widened.
What's she doing here?
He exclaimed.
She said that your letters must have gone astray. Not a single one of them reached her. You did write to her, didn't you, Your Excellency?
Well, I was intending to.
Itania looked slightly embarrassed.
Something always seemed to come up, though.
I'm sure she'll understand.
Tinian's face was blandly expressionless.
Anyway, after she handed the city of Sinestra over to Bergsten, she decided to come looking for you.
Itania's expression was slightly worried.
I hadn't counted on that, he confessed.
What's this?
Betwana asked curiously.
Ambassador Itania and Etana Maris became good friends while he was in Sinestra, Your Majesty, Sophronia explained. Very good friends, actually.
Ah,
Betwana said.
It's a little unusual, but it's not unheard of, and Maris has always been an impulsive girl.
Although the Aton Queen still wore deep mourning, she seemed to have abandoned her ritual silence.
A word of advice, Itania Ambassador, if you'd care to hear it.
Of course, Your Majesty.
It's not at all wise to toy with the affections of an Aton woman. It might not seem so, but we're very emotional. Sometimes we form attachments that aren't really appropriate.
She did not look at Engessa as she said it.
Appropriate or not, however, those emotions are extremely powerful, and once the attachment is formed, there's very little we can do about it.
I see, he said. I'll definitely keep that in mind, Your Majesty. Do you want me to go find Barret and Khalad and bring them back here, friend Vanyan? Kring asked.
Vanyan considered it.
We'd better stay away from that gate, he decided. The seer guy might be watching. Barret and Khalad are supposed to be there, but we aren't. Let's not stir anything up until Sparhawk sends word that his wife's safe. Then we'll all go in. There are a number of accounts that are long past due, and I think the time's coming when we'll want to settle up.
The ledge that ran along the back of the palace made reaching the central tower a matter of hardly more than a casual stroll. It still took time, however, and Sparhawk was acutely aware of the fact that the night was already more than half over. Mirtai and Talon moved up the side of the tower quickly, but the rest of them, roped together for safety, made much slower progress. Sparhawk was peering upward when Calton joined him.
Sparhawk, where's Afriel?
The blonde Pandian asked quietly.
Everywhere. Didn't she tell you? Very funny.
Calton looked off toward the east.
Are we going to make it before it starts getting light?
It could be close. There seems to be some kind of balcony just above us. And lighted windows.
Are we going around them?
I'll have Talon take a look. If there aren't too many seer guy in the room, we might be able to finish this climb inside.
Let's not take chances, Sparhawk. I'll climb all the way to the moon if I have to. Go ahead on up. I've got the rope tied off.
Right.
Sparhawk started to climb again. A slight breeze had come up, brushing the basalt wall with tenuous fingers. It was not strong enough to pose any dangers as yet, but Sparhawk definitely didn't want it getting any stronger.
"You're out of condition, Sparhawk,"
Mirtai told him critically when he reached the spot just below where she and Talon clung to the wall.
"Nobody's perfect. Can you make out any details of that balcony yet?"
"I was just going to swing over and have a look," Talon replied. He untied the rope from about his waist and began working his way across the wall toward the balcony.
"You're making me cross, Sparhawk."
Aphriel's voice seemed very loud in the silence of his mind.
"I have plans for that young man, and they don't include scraping him up off a street 500 feet below."
"He knows what he's doing. You worry too much. As long as you're here, could you give me a few details about the top of this tower?"
"There's a separate building up there, probably an afterthought of some kind. It's got the 3 rooms, a guard room for the platoon or so of ceremonial troops, the cell where Mother and Aileen are being held, and a large room across the front. St. Theocles spends most of his time there."
"St. Theocles?"
"The king of the seer guy. He's an idiot. They all are, but he's worse than most."
"Is there a window in Aelana's cell?"
"A small one. It's barred, but you couldn't get through it anyway. The building up there is smaller than the rest of this tower, so there's a kind of parapet that runs all the way around it."
"Do those guards patrol it?"
"No. There's no real need for that. It's the highest place in the city, and the notion that somebody might scale the tower has never occurred to this here guy."
"Is St. Theocles up there right now?"
"He was, but I think he might have left since I looked in through the window. Zalassa was with him, and Akatis. There was some sort of gathering they were planning to attend."
There was a low whistle, and Sparhawk looked toward the balcony. Talon was motioning to him.
"I'm going to go have a look," Sparhawk told Mirtai.
"Don't be too long," she cautioned. "The night's starting to run out on us."
He grunted and started across toward the balcony. The drawbridge was down, and no one was standing watch.
"How very convenient,"
Elisun said, as she, Lyatris, and Gehenis crossed the bridge into the courtyard of the castle.
"Chaco thinks of everything, doesn't she?"
"I thought there were supposed to be church knights on guard here," Gehenna said. "Chaco couldn't bribe them, could she?" "Lord Vanyan took his knights with him,"
Lyatris replied.
"The responsibility for guarding the castle's been turned over to ceremonial troops from the main garrison. Some officer is probably quite a bit richer than he was yesterday. You've been here before, Elisun. Where can we find our husband?"
"He's usually up on the second floor. There are royal apartments there.
We'd better get up there in a hurry. That unguarded gate makes me very nervous. I doubt that we'd be able to find a guard anywhere in the castle, and that means that Chakol's assassins have free access to Sarabian."
The balcony appeared not to have been used for at least a generation. Dust lay deep in the corners, and the thick crust of bird droppings on the floor was undisturbed. Talon was crouched beside the window, peering around the edge, when Sparhawk came up over the stone balustrade.
"Is there anybody in there?" the big Pandian whispered.
"A whole crowd,"
Talon whispered back.
"Zalasta just came in with a couple of seer guy."
Sparhawk joined his young friend and looked in. The room appeared to be some kind of torchlit throne room. The balcony where Sparhawk and Talon crouched was above the level of the floor, and was reached from the inside by a flight of stone stairs. There was a slightly raised dais at the far end of the room, with a throne carved from a single rock at the back of it. A well-muscled, handsome man in an ornate breastplate and a short leather kirtle sat there, surveying the men around him with an imperious expression. Zalasta stood to one side of the man on the throne, and a wrinkled man in an ornamented black robe was at the front of the dais, speaking in his own language. Sparhawk swore and quickly cast a spell that would attract the notice of the child goddess.
"Now what?"
Afriel's voice sounded in his mind.
"Can you translate for me?"
"I can do better than that."
He seemed to hear a faint buzzing sound and felt a momentary giddiness.
"And even now those forces do surround the sacred city,"
the wrinkled man was saying in a language Sparhawk now understood. A man with iron-gray hair and powerfully muscled arms stepped forward from the gathering before the dais.
"What is there to fear, Akatis?"
he asked in a booming voice.
"Mighty Sirgon clouds the eyes of our enemies as he has for 100 centuries. Let them crouch among the bones beyond our valley and seek vainly the gates of illusion. They are as blind men and pose no danger to the hidden city."
There was a murmur of agreement from the others standing before the dais.
"General Ospados speaks truth,"
another armored man declared, also stepping forward.
"Let us, as we have always, ignore these puny foreigners at our gates."
"Shameful,"
another bellowed, stepping to the front, some distance from the two who had already spoken.
"Will we hide from inferior races? Their presence at our gates is an affront that must be punished."
"Can you make out what they're saying?" Talon whispered.
"They're arguing," Sparhawk replied.
"Really?" Talon's tone was sardonic. "Could you be a little more specific, Sparhawk?"
"Evidently, Afriel's cousins have managed to get everybody here. From what the fellow in the black robe was saying, the city's surrounded.
It's a comfort to have friends nearby. What do these people plan to do about it?"
"That's what they're arguing about. Some of them want to just sit tight. Others want to attack."
Then Zelasta came to the front of the dais.
"Thus says Eternal Clell," he declared. "The forces beyond the gates of illusion are as nothing. The danger is here within the walls of the hidden city. Annika is even now within the sound of my voice."
Sparhawk swore. "What's wrong?" Talon demanded.
"Zelasta knows we're here."
"How did he find that out?"
"I have no idea. He says that he's speaking for Clell, and Clell can probably feel Bellium."
"Even through the gold?"
"The gold might hide Bellium from Sirgon. But Bellium and Clell are brothers. They can probably feel each other halfway across the universe, even when there are whole suns burning between them."
Sparhawk held up his hand. "He's saying something else." He leaned closer to the window.
"I know you can hear me, Sparhawk," Zelasta said in a loud voice,
speaking in Alenic.
"You're Bellium's creature, and that gives you a certain amount of power. But I am Clell's now. And that gives me just as much as you have."
Zelasta sneered.
"The disguises were very clever, but Clell saw through them immediately. You should have done as you were told, Sparhawk. You've doomed your two young friends, and there's not a single thing you can do about it."
There were a half dozen men in nondescript clothing in the hallway outside the door to the room where the Emperor had been the last time Elisun had visited him. Elisun did not even think.
"Sarabian,"
she shouted,
"lock your door."
The Emperor, of course, did not. After a momentary shocked pause, while the assassins froze in their tracks and Lyatris blistered the air around her with curses even as she drew her daggers, the door burst open and Sarabian, dressed in a lean hose, a full-sleeved linen shirt, and with his long black hair tied back, lunged out into the hallway, rapier in hand. Sarabian was tall for a Tommel, and his first lunge pinned an assassin to the wall opposite the door. The Emperor whipped his sword free of the suddenly collapsing body with a dramatic flourish.
"Quit showing off,"
Lyatris snapped at her husband, as she neatly ripped one of the assassins up the middle.
"Pay attention."
"Yes, my love," Sarabian said gaily, crouching again into an on guard. Elisun had only a small, neat dagger with a 5-inch blade.
"It was long enough, though."
An Arjunai assassin with a foot-long poniard parried Sarabian's next thrust, and snarling spitefully, plunged his needle-like dagger at the Emperor's very eyes. Then he arched back with a choked cry. Elisun's little knife, sharp as any razor, had plunged smoothly into the small of his back, ripping into his kidneys. It was Gehenis, however, who shot them all. Her weapon was a slim, curved knife. With a shrill scream, the jug-eared Tegan Empress flew into the middle of the fray, slashing at the faces of Chakol's hired killers. Screeching, Gehenis hacked at the startled assailants, and Sarabian took advantage of every lapse.
His thin blade whistled as he danced the deadly dance of thrust and recover. This is not to say that the Emperor of Tamale was a master swordsman. He was fairly skilled, but Stragan might have found room for criticism. In truth, it was the wives who carried the day, or night in this case. "Inside, my dear ones," Sarabian said, thrusting his savage women toward the door while he slashed at the empty air over the fallen assassins. "I'll cover your backs."
"Oh, dear,"
Lyatris murmured to Elisun and Gehenus.
"He's such a baby."
"Yes, Lyatris,"
Elisun replied, wrapping one arm affectionately about her ugly Tegan sister.
"But he's ours."
"Crane's coming," Khalad said quietly,
pointing at the shadowy horseman galloping across the bone-littered gravel in the moonlight. "That's not a good idea," Barrett said, frowning. "Somebody might be watching." The Domi reached them and reined in sharply.
"Come away," he urged.
"What's wrong?" Barrett demanded.
"The child goddess says for you to come back to where the others are. The seer guy are coming out to kill you." "I was wondering how long it was going to take them to decide to try that," Khalad said, swinging up into his saddle. "Let's go, Barrett."
Barrett nodded, reaching for Farron's reins. "Is Lord Vanyan going to do anything when the seer guy come out?" he asked Kring. Kring's answering grin was wolfish.
"Friend Ulof has a little surprise for them when they come through the gate," he replied.
Barrett looked around. "Where is he?" he asked. "I don't see him."
"Neither will the seer guy, until it's too late. Let's get back away from this cliff. We'll let them see us when they come out. They've been ordered to kill you, so they'll come running after us. Friend Ulof has 6 or 8 very hungry trolls with him, and they'll be right on top of the seer guy when they come out."
"Did he know where you were?" Colton asked tensely as they clung to the wall.
"I don't think so," Sparhawk replied. "He knows that I'm somewhere in the city, but there are several ways I could be listening to him. I don't think he realized just how close I was when he started making threats."
"Are Barrett and Khalad going to be all right?" Sparhawk nodded.
"Afriel was with me when Zalasta made his little speech. She's taking care of it."
"All right, Sparhawk," Mirtai called from above them. "Here comes the rope."
The free end of the rope came slithering down out of the dimness above them, and Sparhawk quickly climbed up.
"How much farther?"
he asked quietly when he reached Mirtai's side.
"About 1 more climb," she replied. "Talon's already up there."
"He should have waited," Sparhawk fumed. "I'm going to have a talk with that boy."
"It won't do any good. Talon likes to take chances. Is Colton still dragging our equipment behind him? I'd hate to get up there and have to deal with things with just my fingernails."
"He's hauling it up, stage by stage."
Sparhawk peered up the wall.
"Why don't you let me go on ahead this time? Get the others up there as quickly as you can. We've still got a lot left to do, and this night won't last forever."
She gestured up the rough stone wall.
"Feel free," she said.
"I don't know if I've ever said this," he told her, "but I'm glad you came along. You're probably the best soldier I've ever known."
"Don't get emotional, Sparhawk. It's embarrassing. Are you going to go up the wall, or did you want to wait for the sun to come up?"
He started up, moving carefully. It was to their advantage that the north side of the tower was in shade, but the deep shadows made it necessary to feel for each handhold, and to probe carefully with his toes for places to put his feet. He concentrated on the climbing, and resisted the impulse to lean back to look at the wall above and the sharp line of the edge of the parapet some 50 feet farther up.
"What kept you?"
Talon whispered as the big Pandian clambered over the top of the balustrade marking the edge of the parapet.
"I stopped to smell the flowers," Sparhawk replied acidly.
He looked quickly toward the east, and saw the faint light of false dawn outlining the mountains. They had at most 1 more hour of darkness left.
"No sentries, I gather," he whispered.
"No," Talon replied quietly. "The seer guy evidently feel that they need their sleep."
"Sparhawk,"
Carlton's whisper came from below.
Up here.
Take the baggage. A coil of rope came unwinding up out of the darkness.
Give me a hand with this, Talon.
He leaned over the stone railing.
Get clear of it, he called down softly to Carlton. We're going to pull it up.
Carlton grunted, and they could hear him moving across the wall to one side. Then Sparhawk and Talon slowly pulled the awkward, bulky bundle up to the top of the tower, being careful not to let it bang against the stones of the wall. Sparhawk quickly retrieved his sword, and then fumbled through the mail shirt, searching for his own. Carlton was puffing as he climbed up over the railing.
Why did you let me get so badly out of shape, Sparhawk? He asked accusingly.
Sparhawk shrugged.
Careless, I guess. Ah, here it is.
He lifted his own shirt free of the others.
How can you tell?
Talon asked curiously. In the dark, I mean.
I've worn it for over 20 years. Believe me, I recognize it.
See how the others are coming. Talon went to the rail and helped Zanisha onto the parapet, while Bevier and Mirtai clambered over on their own. It took only a couple of minutes for the knights to rearm themselves.
Where did Talon go?
Carlton whispered, looking around.
He's snooping, Mirtai replied, settling her sword belt into place. I think it's called scouting,
Bevier corrected her. She shrugged.
Whatever.
Then Talon came back.
I think I found what we're looking for, he said softly.
There's a small window with a sort of iron grate over it. It's up high, so I didn't look in. Is Afriel coming back? Bevier asked. Should we wait for her?
Sparhawk shook his head. It's going to start getting light before long. Afriel knows what we're doing. She's making sure the others are all in place.
Talon led them around to the east side of the tower.
Up there,
he whispered, pointing at a small, barred window about 10 feet up the side of the rough wall.
Do any of the windows on the front side have bars?
Sparhawk asked him.
No, and they're bigger and closer to the floor. That's it, then.
Sparhawk fought back an urge to shout with exultation.
Afriel described that window to me.
Carlton squinted up at the iron-grated window high in the wall.
Let's make sure of this before we start to celebrate.
He braced his hands on the wall and set his feet wide apart.
Climb up and take a look, Sparhawk.
Right. Sparhawk put his hands on his friend's arms and climbed up his broad back. He set his feet carefully on Carlton's shoulders and slowly straightened, reaching up to grasp the rusty grating that covered the window. He pulled his face up and peered into the darkness.
Aelana, he called softly.
Sparhawk?
Her voice was startled.
Please, keep your voice down. Are you all right?
I am now. How did you get here?
It's a long story. Is Aelene there, too?
Right here, Prince Sparhawk, the girl's silvery voice replied. Is Carlton with you?
I'm standing on his shoulders right now. Can you make a light of any kind?
Absolutely not.
Aelana's voice was stricken.
What's wrong?
They've cut off all my hair, Sparhawk.
She moaned.
I don't want you to look at me.
Chapter 32 Talon dropped back to the parapet from the small window.
I can get through it,
he whispered confidently.
What about that iron grate?
Carlton demanded.
It's ornamental.
It wasn't very good to begin with, and it's been there for at least a couple of centuries. It won't take long to work it loose.
Let's hold off until Zanisha gets back.
Sparhawk decided.
I want to know what we're up against before we start crashing around.
I'm not trying to be offensive,
Mirtai said softly to Talon,
but I don't see what good it's going to do us to have you inside the cell when the fighting starts and a half-dozen Sirgai rush into the cell to kill Aelana and Aelene.
It's on account of the fact that they ain't a-gonna get in the cell, Dorlan,
he said with an outrageous grin.
The door's locked.
They've got a key.
Give me about a half a minute with the lock, and their key won't fit. They won't get in. Trust me.
Are there alternatives?
Bevier asked.
Not in the amount of time we've got left before it starts getting light,
Sparhawk replied with a worried glance at the eastern horizon.
Carlton, go up and have a look at that grating.
Right,
The blonde Pandian climbed up to the small window, took hold of the ancient iron lattice in both hands, and began to heave on it. Crumbs and fragments of mortar began to shower down on the rest of them.
Quietly,
Mirtai whispered urgently at him.
It's already loose,
he reported in a hoarse whisper.
The mortar's rotten.
He stopped wrenching at the bars and leaned closer to the window.
Aelana wants to talk to you, Sparhawk,
he called down softly. Sparhawk climbed back up to the window.
Yes, love, he whispered into the darkness.
What are you planning, Sparhawk?
She murmured, her voice so near that it seemed he could almost touch her. We're going to pull the bars loose, and then Talon's going to crawl through the window. He'll jam the lock so the people outside can't get into the cell. Then the rest of us will rush the guards. Is Zelasta out there anywhere?
No. He and Akatis went to the temple. He knows that you're here, Sparhawk. He sensed you somehow. Santhiocles has men searching the city for you right now.
I think we're ahead of them. I don't believe they realize that we're already up here.
How did you get up here, Sparhawk? All the stairways are guarded.
We climbed up the outside of the tower. When do those guards out there start stirring around?
When it begins to get light, usually. They cook what passes for food around here in the guard room. Then a couple of them bring breakfast to Aelin and me.
Your breakfast might be a little late this morning, love, he whispered with a tight grin. I think the cooks might have other things on their minds before long.
Be careful, Sparhawk.
Of course, my queen.
Sparhawk,
Mirtai called up softly.
Zamisha's back.
I have to run now, dear, he whispered into the darkness. We'll have you out of there shortly. I love you.
What a lovely thing to say.
Sparhawk quickly climbed back down to the parapet.
Welcome back, Anaray, he greeted Zanisha.
Thou art in a peculiar humor, Annika, she replied in a slightly puzzled tone.
I just had a chat with my wife, Anaray, he said. That always brightens my day. How many guards will we have to deal with?
I do fear me that they number some score or more, Annika.
That could be a problem, Sparhawk, Bevier noted. They're Sirgai and none too bright, but 20 of them might give us some trouble.
Maybe not, Sparhawk disagreed. Afriel said that there are only 3 rooms up here. The main room, the cell where Aelana and Aelin are, and the guard room. Was she right, Anaray?
Indeed, she replied. The cell and the guard room are here on this north side. The main room is on the south, overlooking the Temple of Sirgan. I did glean from the sleepy thought of such Sirgai who were awake that this ultimate tower is the customary retreat of King Santhiocles, for he doth take some pleasure in surveying his domain from the parapet, and above all, in receiving the adulation of his subjects in the city below.
Stupid, Mirtai muttered. Doesn't he have anything better to do?
Zanisha smiled faintly.
Much else would be quite beyond him, Aetana. His guardsmen, limited though they themselves are, do hold their king's understanding in low regard. But his wits, or lack thereof, are of little moment. Santhiocles is the descendant of the royal house, and his sole function is to wear the crown.
A hat rack could do that, Talon noted.
Truly.
Do the guardsmen have any kind of set routine? Bevier asked.
Nay, Sir Knight. They do but hold themselves in readiness to respond to the commands of their king. Nothing more. In truth, they are trumpeteers rather than warriors. Their primary duty is to announce with brazen notes to their fellow citizens that Santhiocles will appear on the parapet to accept the adulation of the Sirgai.
End of side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.